calls that. But it's not really relevant, of course, to what I'll be doing in lectures. But that's fine. So the basic idea is, so you can use the tiling to simulate kind of the trajectory of a Turing machine. So the idea is we're going to have one layer of tiles represent the Turing machine at time 0, and another layer at time 2. So time is going to go up here, okay? Or time 1 and time 2, et cetera. And so a Turing machine has a head and it has a tape. And so the head has just a finite number of states, and then it can move left, right, et cetera. So for instance, if at time 0 the head is here, well, so the tiles then will have to represent both the states of the head and the states of the tape. So for instance, if the head is here, then these will have tiles that represent the state of the tape. And this tile will then represent the state of the head and of the tape beneath it. So you need enough types of tiles to take all that into account. And then you need some matching rules which basically force the head to follow the Turing machine rules as it goes from layer to layer.
So you also think of the matching rules that you can translate directly into tile matching rules.
There's probably a bunch of different ways of doing this exactly, but the point is that you can only have a head location here if there was a head in one of these places at the previous time step. So that's kind of a diagonal rule. So maybe depending on exactly how you arrange things, maybe you can offset them slightly, or you can have some other rule here that says, well, we have one below and one to the right. Yeah. So it'd be things like that. And then you also have additional things which make sure that this head state is a valid transition from this head state, yeah, and that the underlying tape things get updated properly. But you can do this. It's just a matter of getting enough types of tile,
okay,
which is still just a constant.
To
take that into account.
So this way, you have like the infinite tip of the Turing machine, and going up, you have the running of the Turing machine, which may halt or not. But like going down, like what I heard was that it halts if and only if they can tile the entire plan. And here, it doesn't hold; it only tiles the upper half plan.
Right. So so there's a couple of solutions to that. One is, you can make a reversible Turing machine, so that such things exist.
Okay.
Another is, I guess, to make t equals 0 have some special initial conditions, and then you can just reflect over the y equals 0 line.
Okay.
Anyway, are there questions on quantum algorithms? Or, other aspects of quantum computing? No, okay. We don't have too many people to be asking questions, but I'm sure you can keep up. Okay, so actually, I wanted to start with something that I forgot to say earlier in the week, which is to explain why I was making such a big deal last week about erasing the scratch bit when you do reversible computation. Okay, I said it's important for quantum computing, and I said to preserve coherence. But now that we've actually seen some algorithms, it's worth stopping for a moment to see exactly what would go wrong if we didn't do that. Okay. So for instance, in Shor's algorithm, we have sum over A of A x to the A in one of the early steps, right? Okay. And to get this, well, we computed this from sum over A to get to this. But suppose we had left over some scratch information, right? So that would be sum over A and then some scratch bits. And these scratch bits are a function of A, right? Because the intermediate calculation that gives you x to the A will be slightly different for different values of A, and then x to the A. Okay? And then what we'd like to do is we'd like to measure this register and collapse to something of this form, sum over J of A0 plus JR, right? The set of things that all have the same value x to the A. But instead, we would get something that's entangled between, so we would only get these terms because we still have x to the A here. But we wouldn't get a superposition, we'd get an entangled state, right? It would be A0 plus JR tensor the scratch bits of A0 plus JR. Okay? And these things could differ for different values of J. So this, if you then just looked at this computational register in isolation, it wouldn't be a nice superposition of peaks. It would be a mixture of different peaks. Or, I mean, potentially. It depends on exactly what these intermediate states were. But assuming that they were all different for the different values of J, well, that would just be the same, looking at this register, that would just be the same as having a random one of those peaks rather than a superposition. And then the Fourier transform wouldn't help you at all. Okay? So the algorithm would fail. That's why it's important to erase the scratch bits. Okay.
So the way we erase the scratch bits is by uncomputing, or?
Yeah, by uncomputing. So that's what that, for instance, that tutorial in the very first tutorial section was about. Okay, so then let's get started on the main topic of the lecture, which is Grover's algorithm. So yesterday I told you what the problem was and why it was interesting. So I hope you remember why it's interesting, but I'll at least write down again what the problem was in case you've forgotten that. So it's this database search, or unstructured search. And we're given oracle O, which maps 1 through N, so 0, 1. And we want to find some value x0 such that O of x0 is equal to 1. Okay? Again, we can warm up with a simpler case. In this case, a simpler case is a realistic one, but it's not the most general one. So we'll warm up with the single solution case, which is to say x0 is unique. Okay? So in this case, it makes sense to treat all x that are not equal to x0 symmetrically. Okay, so the only states we're going to have to deal with then are x0, which let me call that S, and another state T, which is going to be the sum over x not equal to x0, x. OK? Now, obviously, the Hilbert space is much larger than this, right? You could have any different superposition of these different states. But when we have no real reason to distinguish different values that don't satisfy the oracle, we might as well just look at this particular superposition. Now, it doesn't have to be the case that this is a good thing to do, but it turns out that it actually works. OK? So basically, we're only dealing with a two-dimensional Hilbert space. which is convenient because then I can draw it on the board. It looks like this. Of course, part of the problem is that we don't actually know which two-dimensional Hilbert space we're dealing with, right? We know it's spanned by S and T, but we don't know, but there's a lot of different possible S's and corresponding T's. And we'd like to find out which one we actually are in, or actually we're going to be working in. Okay? So so within this Hilbert space, oh, yeah.
Are we really treating a
two-dimensional
Hilbert space, or
are
we just some total?
Well, so this is a two-dimensional Hilbert space that's embedded
in a huge figure one.
Yeah. In an n-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay. And like I said, there's a lot of different possible two-dimensional Hilbert spaces, and this is just one of the ones that could be the question. Okay? So what can we do in this two-dimensional Hilbert space? Well, if we have some arbitrary state psi here, well, what we can do is we can apply the oracle. Right? And what does that do? Well, the most convenient thing is to use the phase kickback method. So what that will do is it'll take any x to minus 1 to the O of x. X. Okay? Right? And so in particular, that would take S. Well, in that case, O of x0 is 1. So this gives us minus S. And T would go, well, everything in here has O of x equals 0. So T just goes to T. Okay? And in general, if we have psi, which is alpha s plus beta t, that would go to minus alpha s plus beta t. Right? So what that does is that's reflection. Over t. So it takes this psi and it maps it down to this. I'm going to call this state minus 1 to the O psi. OK? OK. But unfortunately, that's not really what we want to do. What we really like to do is take psi and rotate it towards s. Right? We'd like to start with some state in this Hilbert space and get it closer to S. And if we can keep on doing that, eventually it'll get really, really close to S, hopefully. And then when we measure, we'll find X0. So how do we manage that? Well, what we have so far is a reflection. But if you do two reflections, then you get a rotation. So let's try to look for another kind of reflection. Well, what else can we reflect over? So what other states in this Hilbert space do we know how to deal with? We don't really know how to create S or create T. T we can almost do, but S, well, that's what we're looking for. So what we can do is we can create this state, sum over X for all X, right? Which is, well, if you ignore normalization, this is S plus T. OK? So, but I'm going to draw it much closer to t because, of course, the norm of t is much larger than the norm of s. Right, right. Did I have a name for this state? Yes. This is going to be u. Yeah, let me make a bigger picture. OK. And then we can actually we can create this state, but we can also reflect over it. Now, how do you create U? Well, U is equal to the Hadamard transform of all zeros. And I guess here, let's let little n equal to log of big N. It's the number of qubits we're dealing with. And so what we want is the reflection that sends, I guess we're going to send U to U and the orthogonal state to minus the orthogonal state. But actually, it turns out it's going to be a little easier to do it the other way. Okay, and to do that, it's easiest to think about in the Hadamard basis. So if we just wanted to reflect over the all zeros state, how would we do that? Well, we do a phase shift for the state that was all zeros, and for everything else, we'd leave it alone. Right. So. To reflect over all zeros, well, basically that's this state minus one to the projector on all zeros. So this is something that you can do, right? You can certainly do a classical gate that says we have n qubits, are they all zero? If so, output one. If not, output zero, right? It's kind of a reverse AND gate for everything. Or you can take the NOT of all of the qubits and then do the actual AND gate, and then NOT again to get it back to where it started. Okay, and then you can do a phase shift that depends on this extra qubit, and then uncompute it. Or you can do a phase kickback to solve the uncomputing. Yeah.
By reflection, you mean as defined over there, right? U goes to minus U.
Yeah, that's right. So this is doing that for the all zero state, but so then to reflect over U, we have to do this in the Hadamard basis. So we Hadamard transform, we do this gate, and then we Hadamard transform back. Okay, so I put it this way, but you could have just as well. I originally wrote plus here and minus here, but that's the same gate, right? That's just differs by an overall minus sign. Yeah.
I know you said, but I'm still a little confused by what negative one to be kept broad is.
Right. So this is just some notation that I kind of made up. I mean, this is actually strictly well defined. This is a projector on the all zero state. Right, and so if you think of this as a matrix, right, then this is minus one to that matrix, which is going to have a minus one eigenvalue for this state, and a plus one eigenvalue for everything else.
Okay.
And then basically it's the thing that takes all zeros to minus all zeros and anything else, any other basis state to itself. Okay. So now that I have this big picture, let's draw what these reflections do. So in particular, here's what we're going to want to do. We're going to start with a state psi, and then we're going to reflect it over t. So this is, what do I call that? Minus 1 to the O psi. And then we're going to take this state and we're going to reflect it over U. So right angle here. And obviously I'm not being careful with the norms, but this is minus 1 to the U minus 1 to the O applied to psi. Okay? Everyone see this picture so far? So now let's put in some angles. So if this angle here is theta, and this angle here is phi, then what's this angle? Well, so psi has an original angle of theta plus phi from t-axis. So we'll have theta plus phi the other way when we reflect it over t. Okay, and then we reflect it over u. And well, the angle between this and u is phi plus 2 theta. So up here, it should be phi plus 2 theta. So effectively, this angle here is 2 theta. We've rotated it by an angle of 2 theta towards s, which is exactly what we wanted to do. OK? So putting this together, so the two steps. Reflect over O. Reflect over T, I should say, using the oracle, followed by reflecting over the U state, gives us rotation by 2 theta. Towards s. Okay, and so let's start to put some numbers in. So what's theta? Well, so I made these unnormalized states, so we have to do a little bit of work to figure this out. But u is superposition of big N different things. T is superposition of big N minus 1 different things. So the dot product of these two is going to be everything. You add up everything but x0. So the dot product is big N minus 1. Divide by the norms, which are big N and big N minus 1. And you get that cosine of theta is equal to N minus 1 over N. Square root. Right, norms are square root of, sorry. Let me do that again. So the dot product was n minus 1. The norms squared are n and n minus 1. So the norms are the square root of n and the square root of n minus 1. Right? So dividing this in, you get square root of n minus 1 over n. There. That's right. OK? So each time we do this, so we'll call this iteration G. This is one iteration in Grover's algorithm. And so each time we do G, we're rotating by 2 theta. So, so if we let psi 0 be u for our initial state, right, which we can make just as the Hadamard transform of the all zeros, and we let psi k be equal to G psi k minus 1, then it follows that psi k is going to be equal to cosine phi k t plus sine phi k s, where phi k is equal to, well, so we start out with an angle theta, and we add 2 theta each time. So 2k plus 1 theta. OK? Everyone following so far? Any questions? OK. So then we just have to add this up and see, well, when does phi k reach pi over 2? Well, that's easy enough. So uh, And the answer is simply we should pick k to be, well, sorry, we're not going to get exactly pi over 2. We'll ignore this 1 because k is going to be pretty large in general. And so we get k is about equal to pi over 4 theta. Okay? And in the case where, remember, we were saying that there was one solution, so and n is large. So when n is large, well, cos theta is this, so that means that sine theta is equal to square root of 1 over n. So that means that theta is pretty close to 1 over square root of n. And that's saying that k should be about pi over 4 times the square root of n. Okay? And of course, if this is not an integer, then we can't stop exactly then. But because n is large, the difference between square root of n and square root of n plus 1 is small. And so, you know, we can get to an integer without being, or we can stop at an integer without being too far from this value. Yeah.
Do we have to worry about overshooting
that? We do have to worry about overshooting. So that's an interesting thing, right? If you look at this, you'll see, well, it starts out small. It starts out as 1 over square root of n amplitude for s. But and then as we rotate after about pi over 4 square root of n steps, the angle is pi over 2. We're at s. And when we measure, we get x0 with high probability. But if we keep going, it continues rotating. And after another square pi over 4 square root of n steps, well, now it's about at minus t. And the probability of getting s is 0, essentially. OK? So in other words, we have to stop at the right time. Or the probability of x 0. OK? So when there's really one solution, and we know there's one solution, this will work fine, because we know exactly how long to wait. OK? Now let's look at the case where, well, first I should ask if there's other questions on this. Yeah?
So when we calculate the k number of times given by that formula.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And then we measure. And with high probability, we'll get x0. And actually, you know, so there's some small chance, since we won't, since this is not an integer, we won't get exactly s. So it turns out you can, in this particular case, where you know there's exactly one solution, you can actually adjust the angles towards the end slightly, so you actually do get exactly s. And you have to do some weird irrational angle. But let's say we don't do that. And there's, so there's some small chance we don't get s, or don't get x0. But we can repeat it, of course, to do better. And we know whether or not to repeat it because we can test. Right, that just takes with one oracle call. Okay, that's the advantage of a problem like this, where when you're given an answer, it's like I said. Remember, it's kind of a model of an NP problem. When you're given an answer, you can test that easily using the oracle. But finding that answer in the first place is pretty hard, which is why we're using square root of n queries. Okay. Other questions on the one solution case? Yeah.
So this isn't a probabilistic algorithm because it's you're guaranteed to get like a correct answer.
Well, not exactly. I mean, so if you don't adjust the angles, so you're getting this You're just trying to then get the best approximation to pi over 2.
Right.
And so then you don't get exactly 0 times t plus 1 times s.
Right.
So then when you measure with some probability, you actually get something from t. So it is, I mean, it's a quantum algorithm, so there's randomness is kind of inherent, but it is probabilistic output.
But like you said, you can repeat it until...
You can repeat it, that's right. But it's every time you do that, you might get unlucky.
Right.
So you can make the probability of failure exponentially small with the number of trials you do. But unless you do this stuff fiddling with the angles, you can't make it exactly 0.
Okay.
So that makes it a probabilistic algorithm. This tends to be the case for probabilistic algorithms, that you can repeat a number of times and make the probability of success exponentially high, but never exactly 1.
So but to be in BQP, it just has to be probabilistic with bounded error.
Yeah, that's right. So that's the B in BQP.
Okay.
So people have defined some other class called EQP for exact quantum polynomial time, where you have to get it with probability 1. But it's a kind of artificial class. Yeah?
Pardon me if this is a little tangential, but the calling of the database search seems to lead to question, because often in databases you build up an index to add structured to an unstructured problem, so you can
yeah.
go and search later. Is there any sort of analogous thing here where you can somehow build up a quantum index that if somebody comes and says, this is the oracle I want you to answer, you can do it n squared?
I don't think so. So the problem is that this index that tells you kind of where to go, which would let you turn this, you know, this unstructured search into a structured one, maybe with log n query complexity, right? If you have a binary, if it's a sorted database, you can do it with log n. The problem is that the index is an order n size resource.
Okay.
So you probably can't do that with anything less than order n queries. If you think of using this for a realistic database, probably it doesn't make sense if you just want some simple information. Like if it's, you know, unsorted and you want to know you just want to look up people by their last name, then it's not. But then it's probably not so useful. Because when you build up a database, you could index it. But this type of thing, if you wanted to use it for a realistic database, well, first of all, you have to have a database so you can do a quantum access. You can query into a position. But if you've done that, what it's good for is kind of more complex search strings. So if you want to do some complicated thing of you want to find people whose last name begins with R. But who were born in, you know, a certain town, and you know they spent certain years, and so then once you start to do that, it's hard to index for all of these things simultaneously, particularly if there's a huge set of you know exponentially many possible questions, and that's what the Grover's algorithm can actually give you a big speed up in cases where it's hard to index for your search type. Okay. For whatever reason. Okay. So let's move on to the many solutions case. So what if there are T solutions? Okay, so we can do the same algorithm.
Question?
Yeah.
Are we happy to get any one of the T solutions?
Yeah, any one of them. Okay, and so we can use the same algorithm, but now we're going to treat all the solutions symmetrically and all the non-solutions symmetrically. So we're going to redefine S and T. Oh, I erased them, so that's good, because we don't need them anymore. We need new S and T. So S is now the sum over X such that O of x equals 1, and t, why don't I call it sum over y to avoid being confusing, such that O of y is equal to 0. Okay? And we can still do reflection over s, right? So reflection over t, it's really the same thing. Because, again, if we apply the oracle with a phase kickback, if we have any x whose output is 1, then it gets a minus sign. And any y whose output is 0, we get a plus sign, right? And so that takes exactly the states in s and turns them into minus s. And the states in t and turns them into minus t. So we're still doing this. Okay? And certainly we can still do the reflection over u, right? That definition hasn't changed at all. That's still a superposition of everything, which is still s plus t. Okay? So we can still do the reflection over u. And we still have this picture. Nothing about this picture has changed. Well, one thing has changed, which is this angle theta. So in this case, well, now cosine theta, we can do the same calculation. But now here we have the dot product is going to be the non-solutions. So that's n minus t, right? And norms, well, oh, right, between u. So the norm of u is still n. And the norm of t is now square root of n minus t, right? So cos theta is square root of n minus t over n. And theta is about square root of t over n. OK? And what that means is that the number of iterations, which still is going to be pi over 4 theta, is about pi over 4 times the square root of n over t. Okay? And if we do this many iterations, we'll get close to s. When we measure s, now there's some randomness. Sorry, when we measure with high probability, we'll get a state that appears in S. There's still some randomness now because we could get any of these T solutions. But with very high probability, we will get a solution. Yeah?
But that requires us to know T.
That does require us to know T.
Are there any tricks to estimate T?
There are. But suppose we do know t. Does everyone understand this part? OK, any questions on this part? OK. So what if we don't know t? OK, so here, let's plot amplitude of s versus time. Okay, we start out, I guess not exactly at 0, but pretty close to 0. Right? If we do one iteration, it goes up, and it goes up and up and up. And eventually, it reaches almost 1. Okay? And then as we do more iterations, it goes down again. And eventually, it hits 0. And then as we keep going, it goes even lower, and it gets to minus 1. And then it goes up again and down again. And it's just, you know, it's a, we're doing cosine and sine theta. I guess this is sine, well, it's amplitude. So it's sine theta, sine phi. Okay, and it's an oscillation, just a sine wave. Okay, and the period of this sine wave is, I guess it's about pi over 2 square root of n over t. No, sorry. Sorry, this is This is a quarter cycle, so it's pi times square root of n over 2. Yeah? This is the amplitude of S. So, inside, right, in this state. So we start with the U state, which has an amplitude about square root of T over N, and as we do more iterations, we look at the amplitude in the current state, psi sub k, as a function of k, which I guess I've written here as t. Let's call it k. That's clearer because we have t using it as something else. Okay? Okay. So what we'd like to know is what this period is, because then we can use it to figure out t. Now, as it happens, we just so happen to have a quantum algorithm that's good at finding the period of functions, right? That's how we did Shor's algorithm. So what we want to do is we want to take the Fourier transform of this somehow. Now, the problem is that right now it's an amplitude varying in k. It's not an amplitude, it's not a state that's periodic. But that's easy to solve. So all we have to do is create the superposition sum over k and apply k iterations of Grover's algorithm. So that's a quantum operation, right? Because it's conditioned on this first register. So we get then this. GK, I guess, is the starting state. Okay? And then this is a periodic function. So we can apply the Fourier transform to the first register. And we get an estimate of the period, which in this case is pi square root of n over t. Okay? Now, exactly as you do more and more iterations here, you get a better and better estimate of this period. And so exactly how good an estimate of t you want will depend on various things. But if your only interest is to find the solution, if you don't actually care about knowing t to high accuracy, you don't have to be all that accurate. You can just kind of get roughly in the right ballpark for t, and then try it for some different amounts of time, and sooner or later one of them is going to work. And once it works, then you've got an answer and you're done. If you actually want to get a good estimate of t, you can run it for longer and get a better estimate. Okay? Any questions?
Can you use that to approximate, like, say,
you can. So one of the homework problems deals with doing Monte Carlo integration this way. The way, which is basically a counting problem. The way I've presented it, you just want to count some very small number. So in that case, you don't have to worry too much about the precision of this. But in fact, you can do this. And you can get speed ups over classical algorithms. It's still exponential, remember, because if t over n is small, this thing is still quite large. T over n is exponentially small, then this is okay. It's a square root of the classical version, but it's still pretty large. But nevertheless, it's a speed up.
It doesn't give you much hope of, like, say, sharp.
Not in the sense of efficiently solving sharp P problems. It extends the range of sharp P problems that you could hope to solve. But that's it. Yeah. Also, sharp P is exact counting, which is hard.
Yeah.
What's a counting problem? A counting problem is, In this case, I've presented Grover's algorithm as, is there a solution or not? Find the solution. But another sensible variant of the problem is to say, how many solutions are there? Okay. So for instance, if you have a satisfiability formula, how many satisfying assignments of the variables are there? Which has, you know, some physics relevance. Well, OK, I didn't really explain the connection of satisfiability to physics problems. But like if you have a Hamiltonian, this is to say a classical spin system, you can say, you know, what's the degeneracy of the ground state? That's also a counting problem. OK? Yeah?
There's another counting problem that would be that how many points in the string landscape correspond to our universe?
Yeah, that's a more difficult counting problem, because there it's hard to evaluate whether the point actually does correspond to our universe. So this all of this is assuming that you can evaluate, given a point, you can evaluate whether it's a good one or a bad one. If you can't do that, then it's much, much harder. Yeah?
Right. So like,
right. No. I mean, of course. I mean, so Grover's algorithm has a huge variety of applications, in fact. I mean, it's counting problems. There's a lot of things, basically, that boil at some level down to an exhaustive search of something. And Grover's algorithm basically can give you a speed up for any of those. Now, what it's not so good at is adaptive search, where you try something, and then based on that information, you update what you know and ask a more informed question. Okay, Grover's algorithm is not so good at that. That doesn't mean that quantum computing can't help speed that type of thing up, but you need to be a bit more clever. But there's a lot of things where ultimately you boil it down to some big list and you have to try everything. And Grover's algorithm is good for speeding that up. And well, you have two problems on the homework set. One, I said Monte Carlo integration. The other one is a little more subtle, but it basically boils down to the same type of task. Okay. So maybe the next question you would ask is, well, okay, so that's great. We can if we have a search of n items, we can go down to square root of n. But can we do even better? Particularly for an NP compute problem, right, which might have some additional structure. So how do we know, for instance, that we can't actually do it in one query? Right? Maybe there's an even better algorithm than the one I showed you. So in fact, if you go on to quantph, you'll see some people claiming that quantum computers can solve NP-complete problems. And almost always what they do is actually they're solving Grover's algorithm with a small number of queries. But the problem is they're all wrong. And we can know that they're wrong without even reading the paper if what they're really doing is trying to solve Grover's algorithm. Because we can actually set a lower bound on the number of queries needed in Grover's algorithm. So if you have any quantum algorithm for unstructured search, we can set a bound number of queries. Okay. And number of queries is omega square root of n. So omega is computer science notation. It means like same thing as O, but it means greater than or equal to instead of less than or equal to. So big O notation means so the algorithm shows that there's an O of square root of n algorithm for database search, unstructured search. Because, well, based on the algorithm, there could still be a better algorithm. But we know that the best algorithm is at least as good as square root of n. And this theorem shows the opposite. It shows that square root of n is the best possible algorithm. Okay? And actually, it turns out that the asymptotic constants in Grover's algorithm are exactly the right ones, too. But that's a separate point. So I don't really have time to prove this. There's a proof in Nielsen and Trang. I could give you a very short sketch of a proof. So that's one option, or we can ask questions or something for the remaining 10 minutes. OK. I can't, like I said, I can't give you the whole proof. But there's a couple of different proofs of this. It's kind of one of the, it's certainly the first, is it? It's one of the first quantum oracle bounds known. And it's certainly one of the best studied and best understood. So kind of there's a bunch of different methods for proving lower bounds on the number of queries you need for an oracle problem. And for this problem, they all work. For some other problems, one of them works and another one doesn't work. But for this one, they all work. So the one I'm going to show you is different from the one in Nielsen and Trang. It's called the quantum adversary method. And I like it because it uses a kind of a clever quantum way of thinking. So the idea here is we're gonna imagine that the oracle is itself specified by a quantum register. Which starts as a superposition of everything. And let's focus on the single solution case. Certainly, if we need at least root n queries to solve it, when we know that there's only one solution, it can't be any easier if we don't know how many solutions there are. Because then we still have to solve the single solution case, but we also have to solve the multiple ones. OK, so, so what that means is that at the start of our algorithm, well, we have our computer, and that starts in some state. Well, it's just going to be kind of all zeros, might as well be. And we have our oracle register, which starts as the sum over all possible oracles. Let's label them by I. And I guess we can put the normalization in here. OK? And then at the end, well, the end, the computer should have found out what I is, right, if the algorithm is successful. So at the end, we have to end up with something that looks like this. The sum over I has to be over all. And then the computer has to know I. And then we should take the tensor product. And the oracle hasn't changed. We've lost the superposition. It's become entangled. But it still says I. Okay, and I guess we still have a 1 over square root of n here. Okay, so the point is we went from a tensor product initial state to an entangled final state. And so the idea of this adversary method is to say, well, you can only create so much entanglement per step. Okay. So in particular, the density matrix of the oracle, it starts as this, if So all ones matrix. Okay, you can see that by just working it out. And it ends, well, at the end, it's totally correlated with the computer system. So it's diagonal, right? All these off-diagonal matrix elements have vanished. So it ends as this. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the off-diagonal matrix elements and see that they can't change by too much. So, in particular, we're going to look at this combination. So we'll call this row kj, absolute value. And once you account for the fact that we don't get the solution exactly, so this starts at, what does it start as? There's n choose 2 off-diagonal elements. And each one of them is 1 over n. So we have this starting at n minus 1. Sorry, there's not n choose 2. There's n times n minus 1. There's n choose 2 below and then n choose 2 above. And then it ends at when you get an answer with accuracy epsilon, it ends at this plus something smaller. The point is it ends at almost 0, right? And in the case where you get the answer exactly, it would end at 0. Okay? And what we're going to show, or what we would show if we had time, if we don't, here I want to erase. Let's not call it a theorem, let's call it a lemma. So after one query, s of t plus 1 minus s of t is less than or equal to 2 square root of n minus 1. OK? So this is s at the beginning. This is s at the end. The difference is order n. But with one step, we can only change it by order square root of n. So therefore, we need omega of square root of n steps. OK? And I mean, you know, fill in the details. You work out these epsilons for the fact that you're not getting the answer exactly. You prove this lemma, and that's the theorem. OK? It's not so often anymore, but it used to be there were a fair number. These are not people who are really knowledgeable about the field. Archive, you know, gets all types. Part of the problem is that sometimes people don't realize this is what they're doing. Sometimes they're doing something that's a little bit different, but basically boils down to the same thing. So one common problem is they have some physics intuition and they say, well, you know, you can set up some tunneling thing. It turns out that actually if you just kind of use your physics intuition and write down, say, well, we'll start out here and we'll tunnel to the appropriate, we'll start out in everything and we'll tunnel to the appropriate state, actually you get the square root of n again. It's very easy to get the square root of n if you just if you write down a kind of generic quantum algorithm that seems sensible and work out in detail how long it takes to take square root of n. But if they're not careful, then they may say, well, it takes time one, but the reason they're doing that is because they're actually involving very large energies. And if you involve larger energies, you can make computations go faster. That's easy, right? Because frequency is proportional to energy, so the amount of and the inverse frequency is how often you can do a gate. Right. So by adding a high energy, you can do a gate in a very short time, and sure, then you can get the answer very quickly. But that's cheating, right? You have to keep all your resources kind of normalized appropriately, and then it takes square root of n. Yeah.
Is there some sort of is it in the evidence then that quantum computers can't solve a complete problem?
Yes and no. So this is certainly taken as strong evidence that quantum computers can't solve NP complete problems in polynomial time. And the reason is because we don't really believe that the NP complete problems have any internal structure, or at least we don't know of any internal structure that we can really take advantage of. That doesn't mean that there isn't some. And maybe using a sufficiently clever quantum algorithm, you can actually find it. Now, there's a class of algorithms called adiabatic algorithms, quantum adiabatic algorithms. And there's a long ongoing debate. Some of the people who came up with these actually think they can solve NP complete problems efficiently. I think most other people don't believe that, but it's hard to give a complete analysis of this full class of algorithms. So you can say, well, here's a specific simple adiabatic algorithm, and that doesn't work. But maybe there's a more clever one or a less clever one, but you do something random. You add some randomness. So the way adiabatic algorithm works is you start out with a simple system, and you have a Hamiltonian. It's very easy to solve this Hamiltonian. You know, it's diagonal in some easy basis. And then you slowly tweak this Hamiltonian and slowly change it until it becomes a Hamiltonian whose ground state is the solution to your problem. So for instance, for satisfiability, you'd have a sum of terms, and each term would penalize you if you violate a clause in the Boolean formula. Yeah, it's very much kind of a quantum simulation. So again, we can analyze, and people have, whether it really is a quantum version of simulated annealing or not. But it certainly has some similarities. And the idea is that if you do this slowly, well, there's the quantum adiabatic theorem, which says that if you start in the ground state and you change the Hamiltonian slowly enough, then you'll stay in the ground state. Okay. So the idea is you start with a simple ground state, you end with a ground state that gives you the answer to your problem. And so the only question is, can you go slowly enough to stay in the ground state through the whole evolution? And it turns out that the amount of time that you need to, sorry, the rate at which you can go is dependent on the gap of the Hamiltonian, the spectral gap between the ground and the first excited state. And if you just have a totally unstructured database, then that gap is, well, actually, it's a little more complicated. But basically, that gap is 1 over square root of n. So you have to go for that amount of time. Normally, the time you have to go is the square of the gap. But when you know where it is, you can speed up. But maybe for NP complete problems, there's some path you can do that has a bigger gap, and therefore you can go faster. So I don't remember the detailed conditions, but basically you need a time. So the usual way it's phrased is you need a time that's greater than about 1 over delta squared.
Yeah.
Okay. So these are Hamiltonians that are, at least for these quantum computing applications, you're dealing with a finite dimensional system. So yeah. Bounded okay. below is not a problem.
Okay. And you do something, so you change the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, so you go from H initial to H final, okay, in time that's greater than 1 over delta, where delta is minimum of the gap of H of t.
So you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, and you start at some state. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't vary that Hamiltonian, you could just like decompose your state into stationary states and they would just oscillate.
Yeah, so the idea is you start, the way that the algorithms work usually is H0 is a very simple Hamiltonian. You know what its ground state is, so you actually start in an exact ground state. So if you didn't change it, it would just stay there.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay, so you start in the ground state.
You start in the ground state.
Yeah, okay, so you start in the ground state, and then it's getting confused. And then if you change it,
If you go slowly enough, you'll stay in the ground state. Okay, now if you do it too fast, if you kind of violate the adiabatic condition, then you can cause excitations into an excited state. Because the energies are changing, right? The ground state energy is changing. It's just you're staying in the ground state.
It seems unintuitive to me that you would change the Hamiltonian and like you say exactly like it seems like you should have some small error. Like
you do have some small error, but if you in the limit of infinite slowness,
okay.
That error vanishes. Okay. I mean, it's kind of you can imagine some complicated energy landscape, and you kind of slowly shift it. Even classically, you can see that it'll kind of stay.
Right.
Now, the thing is, classically, you can have a ground state here and a ground state here, and they might. So this one is lower than this.
Yeah.
So you start here. And then you can go like this and have the energy down here. Quantum mechanically, what happens in that case usually is you get this avoided crossing thing. And that's where you get the small gap that appears here.
Yeah.
And the question is, how small does it get? And that tells you how slow you have to go.
Okay.
Because in this vicinity, it's very easy to accidentally jolt it and bump it up just a little bit in energy to this higher state. And then it'll adiabatically stay on this one.
So by going slower and slower, you can arbitrarily decrease the probability that when you measure at the end of the procedure, you'll be in some state other than ground state?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And exactly how slow is, the usual thing is 1 over the gap squared. There's also some derivatives of the Hamiltonian that appear, norm of derivatives, stuff like that.
Good.
So the detailed theorem you have to look up. Okay. So ran over, but.
Okay, I think that's a little bit of a side tradition.
Yeah, that definitely is.
So is this?